Well, welcome back to our time together, Genesis 1 through 11. It's good to see everybody. Let me open us first in a word of prayer, and then we'll get into our topic for today. Our Father in heaven, Lord, we're grateful for the opportunity we have to come together to encourage each other, to study your text together, and see more of your character, Lord, in the text. We pray that you would give us insight to understand better who you are as our Redeemer, as our Creator. And Father, that we would understand your character better, we would come to worship you better. Bless our time together, may it be an encouragement to all of us, and help us to be faithful as we interpret your text. Give us insight into your text, Lord. Open our minds to see the wonders that are in your word. And bless our time together. We pray those things in the name of Jesus. Amen. Okay, so we were in Genesis 1 and 2 last week. So Genesis 1 and 2, today we have a big task. We've got a really big task to undertake Genesis 3, 4, and 5. Genesis 3, 4, and 5. And boy, there is a great deal in Genesis 3, 4, and 5, as you all know. Next week, we're going to take a look at the flood. So 6, 7, and 8, we'll see how far we get into chapter 9. And the week after that, we'll take a look at the rest of chapter 9 as needed, and then 10 and 11. And there's a lot to talk about in 9, 10, and 11 as well. Not only the Noahic covenant that's there, the first covenant, we'll talk about the nature of that covenant, but also Babel. And what are the languages that we're talking about? What are the nations? How do they disperse? And how do they go out after the Tower of Babel? What exactly is happening there? But we've got a great deal of history to cover before we get to that point. So let's start in Genesis chapter 3. Genesis 1 and 2, last week, hopefully it was an encouragement to you. Hopefully it was a picture to you of the way that things are supposed to be. We talked about that word good, right? And God says that it's good. So God creates something. We saw a pattern. So God creates light, or he says, let there be light. And then light comes into existence. And then God says the light is good, or sees that the light is good. And then you have the evening and morning on a certain day. So we see a pattern in particular of creation. And we have this statement by God, or the statement in the text, that it was good, it was good, it was good. And it's this idea of perfection. It's this idea that God created something, and that that thing, that person, that animal, that whatever that it is doing exactly what God created it to do. There's no variance. There's no question mark. Is it going to do what God created it to do or not? There's no question mark of that at all. And when we think about, even in terms of sanctification, the Apostle Paul is going to pull on this idea in Romans. And he's going to talk about sanctification and the process of becoming more and more as God created you to be, as you're supposed to be. So Romans 6, 7, and 8. What does it look like to be sanctified, to operate, to do, to act, to think in a way that God created you to do that, right? Because that's what brings blessing. Today, we're going to see this major contrast between blessing and cursing. Blessing is doing that which God created you to do. You find your greatest satisfaction. You find your greatest joy. You are created to do and to function in a particular way, to think in a particular way. And the problem with sin, of course, is that it corrupts that. So there's a great deal of detail when we come into 3. And there are, I'm just going to say that there are more questions that are coming to your mind, probably, than answers. And I don't mean to just, you know, let's only question the text. There's many, many answers that we see in 3, 4, and 5. But in my own mind, as I study this text, this is, as I mentioned last Sunday, this is a different world. It's just, there's description that's given, and it's just like, well, you should just know that this is how it was. But there's no explanation given as to why do we have a talking snake? Why is that not considered weird? Why is that not bizarre? If a snake comes up to us today and starts talking, then, you know, something's wrong. There's something wrong here. It's probably not a great situation, however that came about. But apparently in the garden, the serpent comes, begins talking to the woman, and asks her a question. And the woman doesn't say, oh, what's going on here? But the woman, Eve, answers the question as if it's just a normal question coming from anyone. So how is it that we have that whole situation crafted within three? What is going on there? What is happening there? So there's a lot of questions that come about from the text. Now, all again, we've got lots and lots to go through in 3, 4, and 5. Just to kind of break it down for us, chapter 3, we're talking about the fall. Chapter 4, the ramifications of the fall, just as far as organization goes. First murder, Cain and Abel. And you have Cain's, kind of like Cain's genealogy at the end of 4. Okay, and then chapter 5 is usually the chapter that people are going to skip, the genealogy. But, oh man, it's important. It's really important to focus in on chapter 5 and see the genealogy that's there, what's going on in that genealogy. Enoch, of course, is going to be highlighted in that genealogy in chapter 5, verse 22. We'll talk about that. But there's a lot to learn, a lot to glean from chapter 5, so we'll spend some time there as well. But lots to go through in chapter 3. So I'll leave time at the end for questions and make sure that I will be able to do all of these three chapters, no problem today. but I'll leave time at the end for questions. All right, let's dive into chapter 3. So Genesis 3, I mentioned last week that there's a connection between 2 and 3. And even in my own mind, there's a question about how exactly are we meant to see this connection? We want to be very careful in making connections between texts. Okay, we want to be very careful in saying that this text is connecting to this other text, whether it's quoting it or making an allusion to it, right? We want to be conservative in how we're understanding those connections. But take a look at chapter 2, verse 25. The man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. Okay, it's a beautiful picture set right at the end of 2 that says there is there's nothing that's coming in between their relationship. There's not, I have a secret sin, a lie, some kind of fracturing of the relationship that I'm trying to hide. Okay, there's nothing to be hidden. And it's a perfect relationship between the man and the woman. It's a relationship as God created it to be, as God intended for it to be. Okay, so it's a perfect relationship that we see. So the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. And then in chapter 3, verse 1, now the serpent was more crafty than any beast of the field which Yahweh God had made. That word crafty there is the exact same word as naked. Okay, it's the exact same word as naked. And you see it used both ways. Okay, you'll see it used both ways in Proverbs. It uses this word in Hebrew. It uses this word to mean crafty kind of has a negative connotation in English. If I say somebody's crafty, it's not a good thing. Has insight or has discernment. Or has like intellectual capacity, okay? That's the kind of word that this is used in Proverbs. It's not always a negative thing. It can be a negative thing if you're using that intellectual capacity in the wrong way, okay? So it can be a negative thing, but crafty, translation is very difficult because every time you use an English word, there's all kinds of connections that come in with that word. So crafty, I guess you could use it in a positive way or a negative way, not in the sense of like making crafts, okay, but someone who is crafty, but it's the exact same word as naked in 2:25. So there's this intentional, again, I want to be conservative, I want to be careful about making connections between texts, but there is an intentional wordplay that happens here. The man and his wife were both arum, is the Hebrew word. Okay, the man and his wife were both arum. And the snake was more arum than any other animal of the field. Same word that's used. And the question is, what's the connection between it? We see the word throughout the Old Testament being used both ways. okay, both in terms of meaning naked and both in terms of meaning having intelligence, having insight or cunning, right? Cunning might be a good way to think about it. Okay, but in any case, the serpent is described as being more cunning, more crafty than any other animal, any other beast of the field. Okay, anything, any other land animal that God made, the serpent is at the apex. It's at the top. Now, there's a bit of a question about how do we take what we've learned later on about this situation that's going to unfold and apply that back into this chapter 3. Okay, in a sense, we want to read chapter 3 on its own. I see a woman, and I see a physical, literal snake who's going to come and talk to the woman. Okay, and that snake is described as being the most cunning of all of the animals that God created. Later on, Revelation, even in Ezekiel, we learn that Satan is that serpent of old. Okay, that serpent of old that the devil is described as. Okay, so later on, we gain greater insight, we gain greater understanding into what is going on within this situation. Okay, we have the devil, we have Satan, who is taking control of a physical, literal serpent and using that serpent for his own ends, okay, for his own gain. Okay, so we learn that later on, though, as it's depicted here in 3, until we get to 3:15, that's where we're gonna spend a good amount of time in 3:15. You all know that passage. We're taking it as a forward-looking prophecy about the Messiah who's coming. We'll talk about that in a second. Okay, but as we take this passage just on its own, I have a serpent who's at the apex of intelligence when it comes to all of the animals that are created. And then the serpent comes and says to the woman, "Indeed, has God said?" Okay, we are going to gain a great deal of insight into the nature of sin and the nature of evil in this passage. And this passage is picked up by all kinds of other passages, both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, to talk about what is the nature of sin, right? This is something that happens to us every single day. When you think about the process of sin, right? As a Christian, I have the ability, as a Christian, to choose what is right, to make the right decision, the God-honoring decision, the correct decision, and I have the ability to make the wrong decision, the wicked decision, the evil decision. Okay, so I come to a crux in the road, and this happens so many times throughout an individual day, a single day. It happens so many times to us where I come to a crux in the road, I say, I could go this way, or I could go this way. Right, and as Paul is talking about sanctification in Romans, he's talking about, well, how do I become more like Christ? Where out of my nature, I'm just making the right decision. I'm making the correct decision every time. How is it that we are sanctified in that way? We gain a very interesting picture here in chapter 3 at this crux point. And this is the crux point of sin coming into the world. Now, again, I'll reiterate, we're taking this as literal. We're taking this at face value. Just as we took creation at face value, just as we took the description of man being created in the image of God at face value, we take this at face value. It's not a poem that's meant to like give you lofty ideas, but didn't actually happen. At some point in our history, the history of humanity, your, my, great, 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 great grandmother, a lot more greats in there, did this in the garden. And our great, 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 etc. father did this in the garden. So the serpent comes, and notice the first thing that's said. Indeed, has God said? It's just a question. It's not a declarative statement. It's not an outright lie. It's just a question. Is it true that God has said this? Okay? Fact checking, if you will. Okay, has God said, you shall not eat from any tree of the garden? That's exactly what God said. Okay, that's exactly what God said. The woman responds to the serpent, from the fruit of the trees of the garden we may eat, correct? But from the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God said, you shall not eat from it, correct? And you shall not touch it, extra, lest you die. Okay? There's no statement in chapters 1 and 2 about not touching it. Okay? Is that something that was added in? Is that something that Adam told Eve? Is that, what is it, what does that look like? Now, sometimes you'll have an idea that God came and created man, and that man is in the garden. God creates the woman and brings her to the man, and then God's like, all right, man, you're in charge now. Like, take over, you're in charge, you communicate everything to her that I've communicated to you, and kind of steps back, right? I don't like to see that particular view. I think that there is an intimate relationship between God and the man and the woman in the garden. I think there's conversations, and we'll see in just a little bit, and we'll talk about even in chapter 5 and the end of chapter 4, okay, about a separation that's now occurring. Once sin enters into the world, God is still around. And by around, I mean like he's walking around. Okay, so he's walking in the garden in the cool of the day. That's not an abnormal thing for him to do. Okay, the way that it's depicted or described in the text, it's not weird. And they're like, what is God doing here? He just came and was walking in the garden in the cool of the day. So it's a normal thing. I think that there's conversations. There's relationship between the man and the woman and God. There's communication that's taking place. There's lots and lots of other things that are said. It's not just as though God said to the man, don't eat from the tree, and then man tells the woman, don't eat from the tree, and they never hear from God again. Okay, so they knew exactly what God was commanding. They knew what God's desire was. Both of them understood what God was asking of them. The woman adds, you shall not touch it. And this is difficult. How much do we, is she adding something? Is she being legalistic? Is she, what do you mean, don't touch it? Right? She just adds something in. So there's a little bit of a twist about what God has said. So the serpent starts out by asking a question. Indeed, has God said, is this true that God has said that? Now, the way that I put it just now is very important for us to understand. Is it true that God has said? Whatever God says is true. It defines what's true. It's the nature of truth. God is not held to a secondary standard. It's not as though God is trying to align what he's saying with this standard of truth. What God says is true. So for the serpent to come and say, has God said this? Right? He's creating a second standard. He's saying, is it true? Is it valid that God has said this? Well, God, if God said it, then it is true, right? It is exactly true. But he just asks, in a sense, a simple question. Has God said? But it's a question. And then in verse 4, we have a complete change. The serpent said to the woman, you surely will not die. And it's the strongest way to put this. You absolutely will not die. Bold-faced lie. The most intense form in the Hebrew that you can give. You absolutely will not die. For God knows that in the day that you eat from it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. And that's all the serpent says. Okay, that's all the serpent says. A question? Is this valid? Is this true? And then a complete twist of the facts. And an appeal to a woman, to the woman's desire, okay? An appeal to the woman's desire to say, do you want to be like God? Do you want to know good and evil? Do you want to know the distinction? Do you want to be a room like I am? Do you want to have insight? Do you want to gain understanding? Do you want to gain something new? Okay, so he makes an appeal to the woman. Sin, we see in this section how sin changes the priorities. I want you to imagine, and we can only ever just imagine, what it was like in the garden. Imagine the man and the woman and their relationship with God. The man and the woman, there is nothing between them. There's no faults. There's no baggage. There's no, you did this 10 years ago. There's no, you said this yesterday. There's no, none of that. Okay? I've changed more diapers than you have. Okay? There's none of that. There's no separation. They have a garden to take care of, something to accomplish, right? They're not just sitting and playing harps. They're accomplishing something. They have tasks every day that they're accomplishing and doing, and they're doing them in an unhindered way, right? So when they go to build their house, when they go to plant their garden, when they go to do whatever it is that they want to do, it's unhindered. There's nothing that's stopping them. It's not, oh, I got to pull up all these weeds before I do this, or, you know, I got to do such and such in order to fix things that are falling apart. There's none of that. That doesn't exist yet. Their relationship with the Lord is their priority, right? They see God coming. They interact with God. They have conversation with God. They're learning perfectly. It's the idyllic state. So what were their priorities? In the garden, think about you're in the garden. What are their priorities? Right? There's no lack of food. What are they prioritizing? Relationship. That perfect relationship that they have between each other. That relationship that they have with God, that perfect relationship. There's so much to learn. There's so much to explore. There's so much to do. Notice how sin changes the priority. And the serpent says, hey, you can have a different priority. You can have something new that God hasn't given to you or promised to you yet. You can have something that's outside of the boundaries, right? So there's a change in priority. The serpent appeals to a change in priority, appeals to a desire, okay? It's good to be wise. It's good to have understanding. It's good. All of these things are good, and the way that sin comes in is to change the priority and to appeal to a desire. Okay, to appeal to a desire that's there, a good desire, and then to twist it. The woman saw that the tree was good for food. It was a delight to the eyes. It was desirable to make one wise. Okay, that's often equated with lust of the eyes, lust of flesh, pride of life. Okay, oftentimes we see the connection made there. She took from its fruit and ate. She gave also to her husband with her, and he ate. And there's some debate, right? Again, we're trying to paint a picture of the garden. Gave to her husband with her, and he ate. What exactly was the picture there? Is the man listening to this whole conversation that's going on, and is he silent? Okay, has he abdicated or not been the leader that he is supposed to be? Right, is he standing right next to her? The serpent comes and starts talking to the woman. Not only does the woman think, this isn't weird that the serpent is talking to me, but the man doesn't say, hey, what are you doing here? Get out of here. Okay, is the man right there with her? Or does it mean she gave to the man like with her in the garden? Okay, it can mean both. It's not specific enough to say right there next to her. Okay, but she gave also to her husband who was with her, either with her right next to her or with her in the garden. And he ate, no questions. He knows what the fruit is. He knows where the fruit came from. He knows the tree that it came from. He got all of the commands, the same commands that the woman got. She gives him the fruit and he eats. No questions asked. Okay, so in the text there, it's clear, Adam is not doing what he's supposed to be doing. He's not functioning in the same way. There's no explanation. Like, is there an appeal? Like, Adam really wants to be wise, or Adam really wants, you know, he's not saying, when we come to the horrible interaction between the man and God, we'll see in just a second. There's not a question of like, oh, I didn't know what I was doing, right? He knew exactly what he was doing. He knew exactly what the fruit was. He took it and he ate it. The eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked. And again, this word comes up again. We'll see it several times in the text, okay? The eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked. Okay, they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loin coverings. Why fig leaves? You read the commentaries. There's so many. Well, a fig leaf, figs represent this, and it has to do with, you know, their desire to cover up their own desire. It's just like the commentaries go on and on. Why do they use fig leaves? Because fig leaves are big, right? Have you ever tried like oak leaves, like sewing oak leaves? I'm guessing that's going to take a long time, okay? So let's just use a big leaf, fig leaf. There you go. Okay, we don't want to read too much necessarily into the text. Okay, they sewed fig leaves together. They covered themselves up. And no explanation is given again. Like, we're all used to just being clothed. We're just used to this understanding, right, of the way that things are, the way that things should be. Well, why is that? Why is that the case? Why is this the first thing that they do? Right? So the eyes of both of them are opened, and then they sew fig leaves together and they cover themselves up. Why is that the first response? Shame. That's to do with shame. And they're understanding that there's a fracturing that's just taken place in our relationship. There's a breaking that's taken place in that relationship now. And any time that you have sin that comes into the equation, you have to have boundaries in the relationship. This is very important for us when we come to covenants, when we talk about covenants. What's a covenant? A covenant exists because sin exists. I have to have boundaries set in the relationship. I have to have boundaries, or if it's a relationship between me and God, God destroys me. Okay, I have to have some kind of boundary in the relationship. And in this case, this is a clear picture. They're recognizing our relationship has dramatically changed between the man and the woman. Our relationship has dramatically changed. There's a fracturing that's taken place in our relationship. I think maybe the best way or that I've come up with to understand the effects of sin is the word fracture. Okay, it's this way and now it's not. There's something broken that has to be fixed. There's something that's displaced that has to be found again. There's something that's broken about the relationship. Okay, so they recognize there's this breaking, and they put clothes on or try to put some element of clothes on to give some kind of distance, some kind of boundary between their relationship to say, I'm here, covered up, you're over there, covered up. Okay, there's a distance between us now in our relationship. They heard the sound of Yahweh God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And again, that's just depicted as the normal relationship. Okay, God comes, walks in the garden, and there's an invitation. There's an invitation to say, and I'm guessing that this happened. We have no idea what the time frame was, but I'm guessing that it's happened quite often to God comes into the garden, walks with the man and the woman. They're chatting, they're talking, they're building relationship, they're learning, they're understanding, they're gaining insight. And this is just a normal aspect of what's going on. Yahweh God comes, walks in the garden in the cool of the day. The man and his wife hid themselves, right? What kind of boundary am I going to put between myself and God, right? The man and the woman created clothes and said, all right, now we're separate. You're over there. I'm over here. I'm covered up. You're covered up. There's distance in our relationship now. Well, they go a step further, right? And they hide themselves from God. Why do they hide themselves from God? Because they want physical distance. The idea is the man and the woman are still together. They're hiding together, right? They have clothes on to create that separation and that distance, But what kind of distance are you going to get from God? Run away. Run away to a different place where God can't find you. It sounds ridiculous, and it's the exact same thing that we do in our sin. Run away. Put some kind of physical distance between us and God, between them and God. They hid themselves from the presence of Yahweh God in the midst of the trees of the garden. And I'll bring out one other idea that Yahweh God, again, I think we sometimes think of this as too abstract, like the Spirit of God was hovering and moving in the garden. No, he's walking. Is God in human form walking in the garden? And they say, let's run away from God. Okay, I think that there's a connection, there's a relationship between this picture and then in Revelation, right? Revelation, you have Jesus in his resurrected body walking. Like we, at some point in the future, as Christians, at some point in the future, you will see Jesus face to face in his resurrection body. You're transformed because you see Jesus, 1 John chapter 3, because you see Jesus, you're transformed perfectly. But there's Jesus at some point in the millennium, in the eternal state, as we're walking, conversing, having a dialogue with Jesus. It's a beautiful picture. I love to see connections between the first portions of Genesis and the latter portions of Revelation. Yahweh God calls to the man, and said to him, where are you? He calls out, where are you? The man recognizes, like, I can't do this hiding thing anymore. Okay, this is a little bit funny. The creator who created the garden that I'm standing in right now, I'm trying to hide from him. So he recognizes this is not something that I can do. He responds. He said, I heard the sound of you in the garden. I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid. I was afraid because I was naked. Okay, I was afraid because I was naked. Going back to chapter 2, verse 25, the man and his wife were both naked and were not afraid. They were not ashamed. The nakedness did not produce any kind of separation. Now, from this point on, chapter 3, all that it produces is separation. Okay, all that it produces is separation. Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree which I commanded you not to eat? Look at the man's response. God comes to the man and says, hey, where are you? What's going on? The man says, I'm naked, so I hid. I recognize in my mind now that there's some kind of distance and separation between us, and I'm running away from you. The man said in response, the woman you gave to be with me, she gave to me from the tree and I ate. In a single sentence, the man blames everyone else that's there except for himself. In one sentence, every other person that's in this conversation, the man has blamed. The woman that you gave to be with me. Hey, God, this is your fault. God, this is your fault. Why? There's something defective about this woman that you gave to be with me. There's something wrong about her. Look at that blame. Let me throw some blame at the woman. Let me throw some blame at God. God, this is you doing something wrong. That's calling God a liar. It's not even saying the woman that you gave to be with me, she gave to me from the tree. It's not even to just throw blame on God. It's to call God a liar. Why? Because God said, and it was good. The woman did and acted exactly as she was created to do until this fall. And the man says, something that you created in her, something that you did, God, was broken. He calls God a liar. You see the effects of sin and how quickly that they take hold? This is maybe one of the most tragic elements of the early portion of Genesis. It's like reading Judges. It's like reading the book of Judges. You know how quickly people descend into absolute chaos and wickedness and evil? How long does it take? Half a second? God comes and says, man, where are you? And the first words that are coming out of Adam's mouth is to say, God, you're a liar. I don't want this woman that you gave to me. I didn't do anything wrong. How long does it take for sin to take effect? She gave to me from the tree, and I ate. Now, I want you, as we're going through 3, 4, and 5, notice the grace that's given. We're going to see God giving grace again and again and again. Yahweh God says to the man, you idiot, what are you talking about? No. Doesn't respond to the man. Doesn't say anything to the man. Sets the man aside for a second. Goes to the woman. What is this you have done? A woman said, the serpent deceived me and I ate. Okay? She doesn't assign blame to her husband. Okay? She also doesn't assign blame to God. Okay? Right here, she just points to the serpent. It says, the serpent deceived me and I ate. Now let's look at the curses and the blessings that come. These are very, very important for us. So starting in verse 14, Yahweh God said to the serpent, because you have done this, he doesn't ask the serpent, what have you done? Doesn't talk to the serpent other than this statement. Doesn't ask questions. Because you have done this, cursed are you more than any of the cattle or more than every beast of the field. Right? That was the opposite of what we saw before. Right? So this is a text of opposites. Okay, so the serpent, chapter 3, verse 1, the serpent was more crafty than any beast of the field. Okay, more crafty. It's at the top, at the pinnacle. Most intelligence. Okay, it's at the pinnacle. Because you have done this, cursed are you more than any of the other beasts. Okay, now we have our first word, cursed. And we're going to see this word come up again and again. We'll see it in chapter 4. So this word is used right here. Cursing upon the serpent. Okay, in verse 17, it says, cursed is the ground. Cain is going to be cursed as well. This word curse, think of it as the opposite of blessing in the sense of something is not only fractured, but I'm going to give greater distance between it. Right? You especially are going to be cursed. You in particular are going to be cursed. So the blessing is you're operating exactly as God created you to do, exactly as God created you to be. Okay, you're operating, you're doing what God created you to do perfectly. You're blessed, you're good. Cursed means I'm going to carry this fracturing, this brokenness, this separation, I'm going to carry it further, okay, even further. So as an example, in verse 17, chapter 3, verse 17, cursed is the ground. So the ground still produces good things. Okay, the ground is still going to produce good things, but the problem is it has weeds that grow up in addition to that. Cain is cursed from the face of the ground, and the idea in chapter 4, we'll see in a second, the idea in chapter 4 is nothing will ever grow for him. He takes a seed and he puts it in the ground and the seed dies right there. Okay, nothing will ever, ever grow for Cain. So the ground is cursed in 3:17. Cursed is the ground because of you. Okay, but it's not cursed to the point of nothing will ever grow again. Right? You're just going to eat from the sweat of your brow. Now, let's go back to the cursing that's put upon the snake. So cursed are you more than any of the beasts of the field. On your belly you will go. It seems as though there's a change here. There's an emphasis upon the dust. Right? And I want to point that out. The dust you will eat all the days of your life. Okay, it's you were exalted, you were at the top, you were at the pinnacle of the animals that were created. Now you're eating dust in the ground. Okay, now you're at the bottom. Okay, so dust you will eat. We'll see dust come up again. Where? In verse 19. Man, hey, remember, you're dust. Dust you are, dust you'll return back to. Let's remember where you came from. Okay, let's remember who you are. You stepped outside of God's authority. You stepped outside of what God commanded you to do. Let's just remember who's the creator and who's the creature. Okay, so the serpent, did the serpent have legs before? Did the serpent have wings before? I'm not sure. This is one of those questions. It's a good question. It's a great question. I've got no answer for you. Verse 15, the most essential portion in chapter 3, I will put enmity between you and the woman. That word there, enmity, is enemy. I will put hostility between you and the woman. You are now enemies, the two of you, between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed. Now, I'm going to run out of time very quickly here. We could do the rest of our time on 3:15. But I want you to pay attention to some very particular things. So 3:15, okay, just reading the text at face value, God puts hostility between the man and the serpent, talking to the serpent. Okay, he's not saying Satan here, but there seems to be this idea that's built in to the text. Why? Because it's your seed and her seed. And then I have, he shall bruise you on the head, you shall bruise him on the heel. We'll talk about the bruise in a second. Okay, but there's this long-standing, like, here's the woman, here's the serpent. Here's the seed of the serpent, and here's the seed of the woman. The seed of the woman is depicted as singular. He will bruise you on the head. Okay? A singular seed coming from the woman will accomplish this. That's why we're taking this as a messianic text. Okay, it's not just here's the woman and here's the serpent, and your descendants are always going to be fighting and battling each other. Okay, that's my mom loved to use this text in reference to snakes. She said she hated snakes. Hated snakes. You just see one on the ground and she would just like scream, hated snakes. Still hate snakes. I hate snakes. How many hate snakes? Anybody have a pet snake? Okay, good. All right. Okay. in any case, I'm not saying don't take that out into the church. You're like Nathan LeMaster said, anyone who has a pet snake is wrong. Okay? Don't do that. All right? But notice I'm pointing out in verse 15 how the text is orchestrated, how it's organized. I have the woman, and I have the serpent, and I have the serpent's seed, and I have the woman's seed singular. And the woman's seed singular bruises the serpent on the head. That serpent that God is talking to, not the serpent's seed. Okay, so look at the latter portion of verse 15. He shall bruise you on the head. Not he shall bruise your descendants, or he shall bruise your seed, or anything like that. And you, serpent, individual, you, serpent, talking to you, shall bruise him on the heel. Okay, so the woman's seed, individual seed, is going to accomplish something against the serpent, that serpent, and the serpent is going to accomplish something against that seed. Okay? It's that gives us this idea of a messianic prophecy. This is the individual seed of the woman who is going to come to accomplish this, and that the serpent is not just a serpent. It's not just only an animal. There's something more significant about this serpent, about who the serpent is or who's controlling the serpent, okay? That's how we're getting to this idea of the serpent is actually Satan, or Satan has used the serpent to bring about his effect, and that the seed of the woman is a singular seed who will accomplish this against the serpent, okay? So you see how we got to that place in verse 15, right? It's just, we want to read the text at face value. I'm not trying to play, you know, mind games or say, hey, the Hebrew says this. You just read it at the face value and you can see we're talking about seed individual of the woman who's coming to effect this against the serpent. Bruise, it's the same word that's used both times. So he shall bruise you on the head, you shall bruise him on the heel. It's a really difficult word to bruise. What do you mean bruise him on the head and bruise him on the heel? What exactly do you mean by that? Something about striking, something about delivering a wound to this place. Okay, so he will deliver a wound to your head, a fatal wound, a death blow, you're done for. And you will deliver a wound to his heel, okay? Not a fatal blow. I'm gonna run out of time, so I am gonna leave time at the end for questions, okay? I promise. It might be 2 o'clock, but I'm gonna leave time. Take a look at what he says to the woman, verse 16. To the woman he said, I will greatly multiply your pain and conception. I'm reading from the LSB, and the LSB did a great job in translating this. I will multiply your pain and your conception. Two separate things that are multiplied. Okay, it's not your pain in conception. It's I will multiply your pain and your ability to conceive. Why does God need to give an increased ability to conceive? Because we have death in the world now. Okay, we have death in the world. So there's the need to replenish numbers. People are going to die. In a world where there's no death, I don't need as many offspring. In a world where this nation went to war against this nation and killed all of their males above the age of 18, I need more people. Okay, so I will greatly multiply your pain and your conception. The pain is a curse. I don't know what giving birth was like before this. I have no idea. My wife and I have two. And I'm going to throw one of my friends under the bus right now. One of my friends had a kidney stone this last week. And kidney stones are horrible. I think that I've had a couple of kidney stones. I'm not sure. I don't go to the doctor. I don't like the doctors. He had a kidney stone, and so he was like joking back and forth with his wife. He's like, "You don't understand the pain, right? You don't quite understand the pain of what that looks like. Like I had a kidney stone. You know how painful that was?" And so they were going back and forth on the pain. I have no idea what giving birth looked like before. You know, before this point, what exactly does that look like? But anyway, in any case, the pain is increased, and also the ability to conceive is increased. And the woman is called Eve, Chava, because she will become the mother of all the living. Okay, so the conception is a blessing that's given. Okay, in pain, you will bear children. Now we come to a really tricky portion. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. Chapter 4, verse 7 is going to use almost the exact same wording. Okay, talking about Cain. And God is talking to Cain, saying, sin is lying at the door, its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. We'll talk about that in a second. It's possible to take this statement, your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. You can take it either positively or negatively. The question is desire. Okay, your desire will be for your husband could mean either your desire to usurp your husband, your desire for his position, your desire to undermine the roles that have been created, but he will rule over you. And that gives the idea of ruling in here and in kind of a negative connotation, right? So your desire will be to, let's change the roles here, but the husband will rule over you, right? You can't ever come out from the way that it was created to be. Okay, that's taking it a negative way. You can also take it a positive way. Your desire will be for your husband, your physical desire. You will love your husband. You will still want to be with your husband. Okay, in pain, you'll have in bearing children, but your desire is still going to be for your husband, and he is still going to rule over you, positive, right? He's still going to take care of you. He's still going to help you. Okay, so I can take this as both negative or positive. There's only one way to take it. I'm not arguing that you should see it both ways. Okay, but just in terms of the debate that goes on within the text, what exactly does the text mean? You can take it both ways. I usually go towards the negative route because of the relationship that I see with Cain and Abel. And when it says to Cain, same phrase, same idea, it's desirous for you, sin's desirous for you, but you must rule over it. I'll come to that text, though, in just a second. And there's a debate. Do I take that as positive or as negative? Okay, so you see there's some debate between those two. So we'll come back to that idea. Okay, then to Adam, he said, because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree about which I commanded you, saying, you shall not eat from it, cursed is the ground. Right? That's weird. Initially, when you read it, the serpent does wrong. The serpent is cursed. The woman does what she isn't supposed to do, and her pain is increased. The man doesn't do what he's supposed to do, and so God curses the ground? And you say, well, where's the curse on the man? Is he getting away with something here? No, because God strikes at the heart of what the man was created to do. God strikes at the heart of what the man is supposed to do. Where does the man find his purpose? Where does the man find his enjoyment, his accomplishment, his purpose, what he's supposed to do? Well, I'm going to take what you were supposed to do in order to work it, in order to keep it, the garden. I placed you in that garden in order to take care of it, and I'm going to curse the garden. And you're going to sweat and work and exhaust yourself for the rest of your life trying to accomplish what I created you to accomplish. The ground is cursed. The man's work is cursed. You could think of it that way. In pain, you will eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles it will grow for you. And you will eat the plants of the field by the sweat of your face. You'll eat bread till you return to the ground, because from it you were taken. For dust you are, and to dust you shall return. Now we're in a cycle. This is the Ecclesiastes. This is exactly what Solomon picks up on in Ecclesiastes. It says you're living in a cycle now. You're living in a cycle. The cycle itself, the system itself is broken. But you cannot get out of that system. There's no way for you to step outside of that system. God is saying the system now is cursed. The system is broken. And so Solomon says, look at everything that I did. Ecclesiastes 1, 2, and 3. Look at everything that I did. Look at all that I accomplished. And I came to the end of it and I realized it's all broken. It's a system that's broken. I build this beautiful building and it falls into ruin. I make all of this money and I work hard and I strive and I labor to do all of this, and then I have to give it to my son who's a fool after me, who wastes it and squanders it. I spend all of this time at the gym. Ecclesiastes 12 is this picture of someone who's just hunched over, old, decrepit, ready to die. Ecclesiastes 12. And he says, it's just a broken system. The whole thing is broken. That's exactly what he's pulling on here. Your dust, to dust you shall return. The question is, how do I get out of the system? How do I step outside of a broken system then? How can I get out of this? The only hope that we see is that 15. There's blessing, there's mercy that God gives. He gives mercy, he gives grace to the woman, he gives grace to the man. The ground is cursed, but you can still grow things. But you have that singular seed of the woman. The whole focus of Genesis is going to shift to who's the seed, who's the seed, who's the seed right after this. All right, verse 20, I'm going to have to move along more quickly. Again, I teach a class on Genesis 1 through 11, like over a semester. We get through, you know, chapter 4, maybe, chapter 5, something like that. The man called his wife's name Eve. In Hebrew, it's Chava. Chaya means life. It means the life giver, because she was the mother of all the living. Your great, 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 etc. grandmother is Eve. Mine is Eve. Everyone in this room's is Eve. Every person on the face of the planets is Eve. And then Yahweh God made garments of skin for Adam and his wife, and he clothed them. This, in verse 21, you got to sit on it for a little bit. You got to think about it for a little bit. He made garments, not just garments, garments of skin, animal skin. It doesn't talk about sacrifice. It doesn't say that God went and he slaughtered an animal and took the skin from the animal. It doesn't give the description of it. Doesn't mention that. It just says garments of skin. The only way to get garments of skin is to kill an animal. Okay, so there is a sacrifice of animal or an animal or animals that takes place for verse 21 to occur. And God clothed them. God clothes them. Their initial response to clothe themselves is correct. It's right. You should clothe yourself. Because there is a fracturing in the relationship now. There's a relationship that's broken, and now we have boundaries around a relationship. There's not a perfect union anymore. So there's a necessity to cover, to clothe, to hide. Yahweh God said, "Behold, the man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil. And now, lest he send forth his hand and take also from the tree of life and eat and live forever." Okay, it's not a complete sentence that he says. It's like, lest this happen, therefore I'm going to do this. And so God places takes the man and the woman out, sends them out of the garden, casts them out of the garden to cultivate the ground from which the man was taken. He drove the man out, casts him out. At the east of the Garden of Eden, he stationed the cherubim and the flaming sword, which turned every direction to guard the way to the tree of life. So where's the cherubim? Where's the flaming sword now? Where's the garden now? I would say that this stayed, the garden, the flaming sword, the cherubim stayed until you have the flood. And in the flood, it's destroyed. So before the flood, people were able to go and see, there's the garden, there's the cherub that's guarding the way to that garden. Apparently, there's only one entrance into the garden. Only one entrance into the garden. And it is protected by the cherubim. The picture of this is that the man and his wife are now like pitching their tent at the entrance. They're east of that garden. And they're stationing there. They're like, where do we go from here? What do we do from here? Where do we go? And so they put their tent at the entrance of the garden or close to the entrance of the garden. And then from this point on, people are just going to keep moving east, 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 east away from the garden. All right, let's move to 4. Man, time moves quick. Okay, 4. So much to look at in 4. Let's start with Cain, of course. The man knew his wife, Eve. She conceived. She gave birth to Cain. This is their firstborn. There's no children born before the fall. There's no children in the garden. We talked about that a little bit last time. This is their firstborn, Cain. And why does she call him Cain? I'm going to keep coming back to names because someone is named something for a particular reason. Okay, there's a equating with the names. It's not always the same today. Okay, but Eve, why is she called Eve? Chava, because she's the mother of all the living. Why is Adam called Adam? Because he's taken from the ground, Adama. Okay, so there's a link with all of the names that we will see. We'll talk about that a little bit more when we come to chapter 5. Okay, so she gave birth to Cain. And Cain, she says, I have gotten a man with the help of Yahweh. I've received his kaniti. Okay, so Kaniti Cain. She names him Cain because she's saying, the Lord has given me a child. So she names him Cain. And she gotten a man, a male, with the help of Yahweh. And then she gives birth to his brother Abel. no description is given of Abel's name. Cain, it's explicit in the text. She called him Cain, because I kaniti, a man. Okay, I gained a man. So it's explicit in the text, very clear in the text. Abel, no explanation is given in the text. She just says she gave birth to his brother Abel. Abel was a keeper of the flock. Cain was a tiller of the soil. So you're like, what is Abel? What does that mean? Hevel, hevelim, hakol hevel is how Ecclesiastes starts out. Vanity of vanities. Everything is vanity. She named her second son Vanity. There's no explanation given, but there's no other reason or link that I can see with the name Abel other than that word hevel. The H just drops in the English word Abel. Okay, but it's the same name. It's the same word. She names her second son Vanity. Why? Because she just had Cain. And she recognizes, oh, I've received a man. I've received a male with the help of God. But the problem that my husband Adam and I have was just passed on to Cain. It was just passed on to Cain. And Cain grows up having the same nature, having the same sin problem that we do. And so she names his brother Abel. She says, vanity. We're in a system. We're in a broken system. And even though I am the mother of all of the living are born into sin. So Cain was a keeper of the flocks. Abel was a keeper of the flocks. Cain was a cultivator of the ground. It happened in the course of time that Cain brought an offering. And he brought an offering to Yahweh of the fruit of the ground. Abel, on his part, also brought of the firstborn of his flock and their fat portions. Now, there's a question. Is the problem with Cain's offering that it is not an animal sacrifice offering? Okay, there's several scholars that would argue that. The issue is that Abel brought a sacrifice offering and Cain just brought grain as an offering. Is that the problem? I wouldn't say so. Because you have lots and lots of sacrifices or offerings that are given. You can take a look at Numbers 28:26. Numbers 28:26 just gives description of grain offerings. Okay, grain offering was a normal offering to make. It doesn't say that they're trying to atone in this offering for sin. It says they're giving a gift offering or a thank offering to God. But Abel says, here you go. And Cain says, here's the best. Here's the very best. Firstborn of my flock, fat portions, the very best is what I'm going to give in my offering. And Cain says, eh, here's something to offer. Why are they offering? There's no description given. There's no description of, okay, why are they making sacrifices and why are they offering at all? What's the point of that? Why is it necessary that, or how do they even know to make sacrifices? How do they know to do these things? They're trying to get the favor of the Lord. They're trying to get the favor of God. And there's an idea we'll see with Cain in just a little bit. He doesn't have relationship with God, but he wants the benefits of relationship with God. He has no desire to be a God-fearer or a follower of the true God, but he wants all the benefits that come with it. He understands in a world that's cursed, I need the favor of God. Okay, I need God to give me blessing, physical, material blessing. And so they're vying for this, or Cain is trying to get this. So Yahweh had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering, he had no regard. So what does Cain do? He becomes angry. His countenance fell. Yahweh says, Cain, why are you angry? If you do well, you will not your countenance be lifted up. In other words, if you do well, am I not going to bless you? If you do what's right, Cain, and you're not just trying to get your way, you're trying to get blessing or whatever that it is that you're trying to get, if you do what's right, am I not going to bless you? Am I not going to lift you up? If you do not do what is well or what is right, sin is lying at the door. It's crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. Now, I'll give you two separate ways that you can take this, okay? The first way is a negative way. It's the way that I take it. It's a description of sin, to say in, like a personified, let's call it a lion, okay? It's standing at the door. It's crouching. It wants to take you. It wants to master you. Same thing that happened in the garden. It's lying at the door. Its desire is for you, but you need to master it. He's trying to explain to Cain, well, in a system that's broken, in a world that's full of wickedness and that's full of evil, how are you supposed to react to the problem of sin? Resist it. Rule over it. Okay? Make the right decisions. Now, it's possible also to take this verse in a positive way. And let me read it to you and with that light. Okay, the idea is sin is not only sin itself, but like a sin offering, like a literal animal that you can offer to make atonement for your sin. Okay, so a sin offering, like if you do not do what's right, Cain, there is a sin offering, which is right over there by the door. It wants to be used by you as a sin offering, and you must go over and offer it as a sin offering. Okay, so you can take it negative, you can take it positive. I lean towards the negative. Right, he's giving him an explanation. Right, he's saying sin is like a lion that's crouching at the door. You must rule over it. And we know exactly what Cain chose. So we come to this crux point. We had a crux point in verse 3 or chapter 3. Right, do I eat the fruit? Do I not eat the fruit? Okay, without even thinking of the ramifications of it, let me just follow my own desire. Let me follow my own inclination. Do my own thing. Be my own authority. Do I eat the fruit? Do I not eat the fruit? The same exact thing happens here. We've just upped the stakes a huge amount in the terms of the individual sin. Obviously, chapter 3 brings everyone into sin. Cain spoke to Abel, his brother. They went out into the field. Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and killed him. It's not depicted as being rational. He's just jealous. It's not going to get him any further. It's not going to get him blessing from God. It's not going to get him what he wants. He's not stealing offering. He's just jealous. He just rises up and kills him. Okay? He's not controlling the sin that's within him. Okay, very famous text, "Am I my brother's keeper?" God says, "Where is Abel your brother? Am I my brother's keeper? What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground." Okay, notice his emphasis again on the ground. It's going back to the ground. The ground is cursed. Not only is the ground cursed, God has cursed the ground, but now I have murdered blood spilled out on that same ground. And the ground is crying out, saying, "This is not right. This whole system is not right. I just had your brother's blood spilled on me. It's not right." Paul will pick this up in Romans when he says that the whole of creation is groaning, waiting for the adoption of sons, waiting for the resurrection, waiting for things to be made right. The ground is waiting for things to be made right. Verse 11, "Cursed are you from the ground which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you cultivate the ground, it will no longer yield its strength to you." Cain puts a seed in, the seed dies. Doesn't matter how many seeds that he puts in, they all die. It will never, ever yield its strength to him. Well, how do you live at that point? What do? You wander around. You're a forager. You have to go around. You're a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth, verse 8. Cain said to Yahweh, "My punishment is too great to bear." Initially, you say, well, why is it too great to bear? Like, you should have been killed. That's too great to bear, Cain. You murdered your brother. God could have killed you on the spot for such a grievous sin. And God says, you're cursed. You're sent out. The ground is never going to yield any more food for you. It's not saying you'll never again have any food. You should go to this place and find the food that's there and eat it up, and then you move on to the next place. And then Cain says, "My punishment is too great to bear." What do you mean it's too great to bear? It sounds like a blessing to me. Okay, it sounds like something much worse should have happened to you, but you got a blessing, you got mercy instead. So what do you mean your punishment is too great to bear? It's because he's separated from God now. He's totally separated from God. Okay, he's moving farther and farther away from God. Think about ultimately, you have heaven and hell. What's hell? The absolute separation from God. Any blessing at all, any form of any blessing, any mercy, any grace is out of the picture. And Cain is moving in that direction. And he starts to understand, like, if I'm cast away from God and I can't be in God's presence anymore, I can't gain any blessing from God. I get nothing from God. I'm moving in that direction. My punishment is too great to bear. From your face I will be hidden. I'll be a vagrant and a wanderer. Whoever finds me will kill me. And God gives him a blessing. God gives him a mercy. Puts a mark on him. No idea what that mark was. But puts a mark on him such that when anyone came and interacted with him or saw him, the mark, whatever that it was, told him or told them, don't kill Cain. And the vengeance would be sevenfold. Cain goes out from the presence of Yahweh and settles in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Nod is the Hebrew word for wandering. He settles in the land of homelessness, basically is what it's saying. Right? There's not like land of Nod. It is the land of Nod because Cain is there now. That's why it's called the land of Nod. Nod just means it's the place of wandering. And it's east of Eden. Cain knew his wife. She conceived and gave birth to Enoch. Who's Cain's wife? One of his sisters. We have no idea how many children Adam and Eve bore, okay? But they had both sons and daughters. So one of their daughters is Cain's wife. She conceived and gave birth to Enoch. He built a city, named the city Enoch after the name of his son. So Cain builds a city and names it Enoch. Now to Enoch was born Irad, Irad the father of Mahujael, Methushael, the father of Lamech. Lamech is not a good character. You all know this, but I want you to see. I'm moving a little quickly through because my time is going. Lamech took for himself two wives. First instance where I have two wives. Everything that you see in the line of Cain, this is in contrast to what we have in chapter 5, the line of Seth. In the line of Cain, you have the first person who takes for himself two wives. Okay, and the two wives that he has, I'll fast forward just a little bit here and come back. Lamech said to his wives, Ada and Zillah, hear my voice, wives of Lamech, give ear to my word. I killed a man for striking me, a boy for wounding me. Okay, we don't know what the situation was. Was it self-defense? Was it not? Doesn't matter because of what he says. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, Lamech 77-fold. Right? He's expecting God's mercy. He's expecting God's grace. He's presuming upon God's grace. Their children that they have, one of them is the father of those who live in tents and have livestock. I wish I could spend so much time on this. What do you mean the father of those who live in? Everyone at this point has tents and had livestock, right? I mean, everybody is that way, right? What does it mean is the father of those? The second one, the father of those who play the lyre and the pipe, okay? Lyre is a stringed instrument. Pipe is a wind instrument. Okay, otherwise, you're using both of those terms. The father of those who play musical instruments. Okay, Zillah gave birth to Tubal-Cain, forger of all implements of bronze and iron. Okay, bronze and iron. So he's a metal worker. Okay, think of it as like the father of something. So, you know, the father of physics, the father of astronomy. Right? You have those terms that we use today. It doesn't mean that physics didn't exist beforehand. It just means that they furthered it to such an extent they're understood as the father of this particular thing. Okay, so this is accomplishment from the line of Cain. Okay, the father of those who live in tents, the father of those who play instruments, the father or the forger of implements of bronze and iron, metalworking. Okay, Adam knew his wife again. She gave birth to a son named Seth. For she said, God has set for me another seed in place of Abel. Seth means to set. Okay, same word. So why name him Seth? Because God set somebody in his place. To him also a son was born, called his name Enosh. Then men began to call upon the name of Yahweh. What does that mean? There's a further distancing now. They're calling upon the name of Yahweh. Yahweh's not walking around in the garden anymore. Yahweh's not, hey, can I go and have a chat with you anymore? Everybody wants the blessing of Yahweh. Everybody wants the produce. Everybody wants that which comes from Yahweh, the blessing. Yahweh is gone. He's leaving. He's distancing because of sin. So men began to call upon the name of the Lord. Yahweh, come to us. Yahweh, bless us. Yahweh, provide for us. Yahweh, give us. Because Yahweh's distancing himself and separating from man. This is going to lead, of course, up to the flood. But even more than that, when we see the relationship between Yahweh and Abraham, Yahweh chooses one and he says, I'll be with this one. Not with everybody. I'm not walking around on the earth, but I'll be with this one and I'll work out my plan through this one, Abraham. Okay, now, it's 12:20. I can leave 5 There's so much to talk about in 6, 7, and 8. We're going to have to sacrifice somewhere. All right. I'm going to give you some major pointers from 5. 5 is always the one at the end, and it shouldn't be. Okay? All right. Bear with me really quick. I want you to see a couple of key things from 5, and then I'm going to open it up for questions. Okay, so Adam lives a total of 930 years. So you see at the beginning, 5:1, this is the book of the generations of Adam. Starts the Toledot, but in particular, it's tracing it through the line of Seth. Okay, so there's a contrast between the line of Cain and the line of Seth. So Adam lives a total of 930 years. He has Seth when he's 130 years old. Okay, Seth has Enosh when he's 105 years old. Seth lives a total of 912 years. Okay, you can go through this entire list and plot out there's this person who begets this person at this age and lives this amount of years. Okay, so it traces it out. We're taking the text at face value. We're taking the years at face value. So in that way, we can trace how many years was it between Adam all the way down to the flood. Okay, it ends verse 32, Noah was 500 years old. Noah became the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So let me plot out some of the years for you. Noah is 500 years old at the end of chapter 5. The flood comes when Noah is 600 years old. So he has 100 years to build the ark before the rains come. Okay, so Adam is 930, lives to be 930. Seth lives 912. There's Enosh, Kenan, Mahalalel, Jared, Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech. There's his own Lamech. Don't be confused with the one that came before. And Lamech is the father of Noah. So there's 1,656 years from Adam to the flood. Okay, 656 years from Adam to the flood. One other key thing to note about this text, if you look at when did this person die, when did this person die, none of the people that are listed in chapter 5 died in the flood, except maybe Methuselah. Okay, so Lamech dies young at 777 years old. Okay, so Adam dies when Lamech, the father of Noah, when Lamech is 56 years old. Okay, so all of these generations that we have, Adam dies when Lamech is 56 years old. So Adam doesn't live until Noah is born, but he's really close. Seth dies when Lamech is 168 years old. Enosh, the son of Seth, dies when Noah is 84 years old. Okay, so I have Enosh, the grandson of Adam, dying when Noah is 84 years old, right? Because of the length of years that they have. Kenan dies when Noah is 179. Mahalalel when Noah is 234. Jared dies when Noah is 366 years old. Enoch, this is really, really interesting to me. Enoch is taken. Let's read that text really quick. Chapter 5, verse 21. Enoch lived 65 years and became the father of Methuselah. Enoch walked with God 300 years after he became the father of Methuselah, and he became the father of other sons and daughters. All the days of Enoch were 365 years. Enoch walked with God, and he was not, because God took him. What does that mean, he was not? Exactly what it says. All the text says is just, he was not. You say, what do you mean he was not? What are you talking about? Every other person is, and he died, and he died, and he died, and he died, and he died. Methuselah, 365 years old, is not. You say, what do you mean? He is not, because God took him. Why do I hold to rapture? Why do I believe in the rapture? Because of verses like this. Okay? Verses like this give me great help, insight, connection with the idea of rapture. This has happened before. Enoch walked with God, and then he was not. Nobody found him again. He was gone. God took him. I think it's a fantastic picture of the idea of rapture. Enoch is taken when Lamech, the father of Noah, is 69 years old, 13 years after Adam dies. Okay, so Enoch is taken 13 years after Adam dies. So in this line, everybody was alive in this line when Enoch was taken except for Adam. Adam was the only one who said, well, where did Enoch go? Okay, everybody asked the question, where did Enoch go? Okay, he's gone. Lamech, the father of Noah, dies 5 years before the flood. Okay, Methuselah either dies in the year of the flood, at the flood, or right before the flood. Okay, so the people that are depicted in chapter 5, the line of Seth, they're not depicted as like awful, horrible people that died in the flood. Okay, for the most part, they're all dead, but they don't die in the flood itself. Okay, so when you have this description of the evil of man was great on the earth, every inclination of his thoughts was only evil all the time, right before the flood happens, those are all nameless, faceless people. Okay, they're all, we have no idea what the population was like. We'll talk about it next time. We have no idea what the population was like or how many there were, but they're, in a sense, they're kind of nameless, faceless people. Okay, so pay attention in chapter 5. You can plot out the ages and see who dies when who is alive and that sort of a thing. Enoch is the focal point by far of the text. And then this sets us up for Noah, who was 500 years old, and he became the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. That's going to set us up for the flood, 6, 7, and 8. We'll talk about next time. Whew. 5 minutes for chapter 5? It's not doing it. It's not doing it justice. All right, let me open up for questions. I did leave time. I didn't say how much time, but I did leave time for questions at the end. Yes, yes, ma'am. Well, when you say seed, the idea of seed in Hebrew, you mean like back to 3:15, where like the seed of the woman and the seed of the snake, right? Is that what you're referencing? Yeah. So the seed there just means like the descendants of. Yeah. Yeah. Like those coming from her. She's the one who's giving the life. Yeah. Yeah. Leo.
So when God covers Adam and Eve.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. Again, we don't know like how much was communicated to them about sacrifice, but in order for God to cover them with animal skin, an animal has to die. And they understand that. Right? They never worn animal skin before, and suddenly God's putting animal skin on them. So they knew something died in order that I would be covered here. Yeah. Yeah.
At the same time, could that be like, because there's no mention of angels, but could that be like Lucifer is the...
I think we learn later on in the text. So in the text itself, the serpent is just depicted as one, right? It's the serpent. The indication, though, is in 3:15 where it says the serpent, like the seed of the woman is going to crush the head of the seed of the serpent. So you're like, this serpent has to be something more than only the animal, a serpent. There has to be something more there. But in the text, that's the only explanation that's given. Later on, when we come to Revelation, when we come to Ezekiel, it's Satan, that serpent of old, is the description that's given. That's where we get insight into seeing what actually went on. So I think I would say it's Satan taking control of this animal who was at the pinnacle of that creation, you know, intelligence, and making use of the animal. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
I was wondering why that in the garden when the relationship was perfect, the state was perfect, how could that suggestion appeal to Eve or to them anyway?
Right, yeah. This is such a good question. It's a theological question. What was the nature of the man and the woman in the garden? Right? Because now we have a nature as Christians. We have a nature that can choose good or it can choose evil. An unsaved person will only ever choose evil. Right? They will only ever choose something that is self-centered, selfish, because they can't do anything from faith. So as a saved person, I have a new nature. And that new nature means that I can now choose that which is good, truly good. So what was the nature of Adam and Eve like? We think that it's something completely different. They weren't saved. They're not redeemed like we are today. They're not unsaved because they hadn't entered into sin yet. So their nature was something that was like a blank slate of some kind. And they had the ability to choose something that was wrong. Yeah.
You wouldn't even think to put that in your
exactly.
Head.
Right.
You are so like, right. Do the right thing.
Yeah. Exactly. So what was the appeal? Right. That's part of the question in the text. Why is it appealing to eat the fruit? Why doesn't she just say, get out of here? Like, I don't even know what you're trying to get me to do. Why would I go against what God has? But the way the text speaks about it, there's some kind of appeal to her. Like she wants to be wise, like God is wise. And so she steps outside of that authority. Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm.
How do you explain to people that Adam and Eve and their kids intermarrying and all that kind of stuff versus later on and what we would say is incest?
Yes, right, yeah, exactly. So you have a breakdown of genetics over time. But it's interesting to note in the Old Testament where that comes about. So Abraham marries his half-sister, or, you know, his sister, Sarai. Sarah is his sister that we learn on later. And that is not viewed as being weird or abnormal. But by the time you get to, let's say, Judah and Tamar, right? So you have Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, and Judah and Tamar. Tamar is his daughter-in-law. And they're like, this is horrible. This is awful. What has happened here? Genesis 37, it's an awful example of just wickedness. And so where does that come about and why does it come about the way that it does? In the previous verses or in the previous chapters, it's not viewed as being a negative thing. It very much becomes a negative thing later on. It's interesting to trace where that is. I think it has to do with just the breakdown of genetics, that sort of a thing. Yeah. It's a good question, though. Yes, ma'am.
The Bible uses the word curse for the serpent, the ground, and Cain.
Yeah.
But should we say that Adam and Eve are cursed?
No. Yeah. It's a very good question. Yeah. They themselves are not cursed. Eve is not cursed. Her pain is increased, but the word curse is not used for Eve. She is not cursed. Adam is not cursed. The ground is cursed on behalf of Adam. That's not a great way to put it, right? The serpent is cursed. The ground is cursed. And then we get to chapter 4, and Cain himself is cursed. But the man and the woman are not put into the category of being cursed. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Touch.
Yeah.
And sort of lie or like sin
yeah.
the truth.
Yeah.
And so to me, I'm like, well, that's sin.
Yeah.
But then God doesn't attribute that
right.
until her husband did. So yep. I'm thinking in Genesis 2,
yeah.
the commandment to not eat was not to eat, but to remain.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, well, the only way woman would know is if Adam had told her or God had told them.
Right. Right.
But then sin comes in through the man. So
yeah.
Is that why it came in at that point?
And yeah.
skewing the truth?
Yeah. There's several different aspects to your question. It's a very good question. You have the command given to man in two, the man, right? Do not eat from the tree. But you have God walking with the man and the woman. So there's relationship there. So I think we could safely assume that the woman even hears from God himself, do not eat from the tree. Or at the very least, her husband tells her, I mean, but they have a relationship with God, discussion, dialogue with God in the garden. The man and his wife, it says their eyes are not opened until the man eats. The man eats, so the woman eats, she gives to her husband. It doesn't say the woman eats, her eyes are open, then she gives to her husband and tricks him or whatever, and then his eyes are opened. It says the woman eats, the man eats, then their eyes are opened. But it's really hard to know how far to take that because it's giving a general statement. They both ate, and then their eyes were opened. And that, you know, they knew that they were naked. But I don't know that we want to push it too far to say, like, when the woman eats, she is in sin. That, like, this has to be the case, that she has sinned there. When the man eats, the man is in sin. But then the eyes of both of them are open. Is that like a blanket statement referring back to say, you know, at this time, now both of their eyes are opened? I lean more that way. I don't want to push that too far. Say, like, when exactly are their eyes opened? Yeah. Yeah.
And all that too, because the fact of the matter is they were perfect in their creation.
Yeah.
And so their intellect was far beyond anything we understand today.
Yeah.
Where now our wisdom and our intellect is skewed by
yeah.
sin and
right.
death. And so, and we spend our lives trying to reverse what we've been taught in sin
mm-hmm.
as Christians.
Yeah.
So there's a real big difference in that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, very good. Yes, yes, sir. Right.
From what God told him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I hear you say that, but is that
well,
what you would go with?
Yeah, that's the question. When it's the she gave to the man with her,
he was there the whole time.
That's the question, though. Is he like right next to her, or is it with her in the garden? Right. You can take it both ways. The man has certainly not done what he's supposed to do. The man has not led in the right way. The man did not protect the woman from the snake. We can see that very clear. So there's a breakdown at that point. There's a breakdown in the responsibilities of the man and what he's supposed to do. But when it says that she gave to the man with her, does that mean like he's standing right next to her, like listening to this whole conversation the whole time and is like, hey, do whatever you want? Not necessarily. Yeah. Yeah. It could just be like she gave to the man with her, who was with her in the garden. Yep.
And then later on, Paul said, no,
yep.
but Eve ate first.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah. we have to say, well, how did Adam sin?
Right. First? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The head she was in Adam.
Yeah.
It's like, because it says, like, the woman is the flesh of my flesh, bone of my bone.
Mm-hmm.
So the truth is they are one. They are mm-hmm. not separated, like, you know. Like those dolls, there are those dolls that you open up.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah,
man,
yeah.
The woman in it, the woman, the yeah. giant.
Yeah. They both sinned. There is no, I don't want to say that. We really do need to look at the passage in Corinthians, right? Where he's talking about headship of man and woman, that sort of a thing. But also, I would say that the first thing that the man does when he's discovered is to cast blame on the woman. And that's the exact wrong response to have. because he's like, the woman that you gave to be with me. Both blame on God and blame on the woman. Did the woman eat first? Yes. Did the man fail in his responsibilities? Yes. Did the man eat? Yes. So you do need to view them together, that they're both failing in this, but chronologically, which was the first, you know?
The accountability, I think, falls onto Adam, because even in every passage, you know, God is always putting the male figures and then,
yeah,
you know, and then responsible, and then the heritage coming through that. So I think
authority and responsibility, yeah.
Yeah. Accountability,
yeah. 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 But that Corinthians passage is very helpful as well. Like, we have to incorporate in all of these different things. Yeah. All right, guys. Last question. Go ahead.
Let's see if I can word this correctly. Since Adam and Eve had never experienced death before they sinned, did God give them an understanding of what they would be losing? Or is it the fact that they didn't know attribute to Eve's desire for what she didn't know?
This is a good question that deserves, it deserves all of you to appeal to Mark Zakevich and say, we need an 8-week series on Genesis 1 through 11, okay? Tell him that. death, it's a very good question. When it says, in the day that you eat it, you will die, they did die exactly in the day that they ate it. They understood what death was because death is... they had true death, spiritual death. Physical death is a representation of that true death. So when you get to the description of hell, it says that Hades is cast in into the lake of fire, which is the second death. The description is that is death. That is true death. We think when we use the term death, we're almost exclusively thinking in the physical idea. Like, my body's decaying, I will die. And it's an awful, horrible reality that everyone experiences. But I would say that physical reality is a picture, an outcome of what true death actually is. So in the day that you eat it, you will die. They did die that day. And then their physical death was a picture that came about later. Lots to talk about there. All right, I'm way, way over time. Appeal to Mark Zakevich. Let him know. I'll see you next week.